I'd like to now read some quotes from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur that I have included in the book Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Vaibhava. The thousands of karmis who have opened innumerable hospitals, old age homes, centers for the poor, and schools, and the thousands of gyanis who have undergone meditation and severe austerities, are insignificant compared to a single Kanishtha Adhikari Vaishnava once ringing the bell before the Lord's deity. This is not sectarianism, but plain truth. Atheists are wholly incapable of realizing this. Thus they become either direct or indirect blasphemers of devotional service or adherents to the doctrine of harmonistic all-inclusiveness. So, the idea that we're helping people by opening hospitals. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that innumerable hospitals, opening of innumerable hospitals by karmis is not even comparable to this, to a Kanishtha Adhikari Vaishnava once ringing the bell before the deity. So in other words, stating that the categorical difference between devotional service and bodily welfare work. Now it may be objected that, well, if devotees do bodily welfare work, then what's the harm? But the implication here is that devotees don't do that. They're not, it isn't their prime concern or even their secondary concern. Being averse to Lord Vishnu, this is another quote. Being averse to Lord Vishnu, countless jivas have come to Mahamaya's dungeon to envy Lord Vishnu in countless ways. To deliver even one of them from Mahamaya's fortress and make him a devotee of Krishna is unlimitedly better welfare work than the construction of countless hospitals and schools. So, bringing people to Krishna consciousness is obviously a lot more difficult than performing bodily welfare work, but it's far better also. People in general won't appreciate that. So it's easier to get appreciation for things that worldly people approve of, but then you become part of them. You partake of their way of thinking. You may say, well, we understand, we're devotees, we're doing it, but we're not the same as non-devotees. But I've given some examples of how it's very easy to become part of the ethos that you're supposed to be changing. It's like if you, the idea that, well, you become a little open to materialistic ideas so that people will at least interrelate with you, and then gradually they can appreciate Krishna consciousness. But what I see, it often happens the other way, that you become like friendly, or you relate with people on their level, and our devotees tend to become more like non-devotees, and the non-devotees becoming like devotees, or the distinction becomes blurred. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur states, welfare work is good, but has two defects. It directly or indirectly encourages godlessness and supports violence to animals and other living entities. Directly or indirectly encourages godlessness. Yeah, the idea, you see, that we're promoting, that we're helping people by opening hospitals and schools. It supports the materialistic way of thinking. Directly or indirectly, it upholds the materialistic way of thinking that this world is the arena for our enjoyment independent of Krishna. And that the only real welfare for everyone is to surrender to Krishna. So if we tell people that, you see, we're helping people, you should donate because we're building hospitals and schools, then we are, by not informing them that the actual welfare work for all living beings is to surrender to Krishna, and encouraging them to act in a manner which they already agree with, but which is Maya, we're actually encouraging them to be in Maya. And by speaking like this among our own devotees, we're, instead of helping them to get free from Maya, we're keeping them in it. So these are some of the problems. Again, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Sri Chaitanya Dev preached throughout the world for the welfare of all jivas, yet the welfare work he proposed was not of the small-minded, paltry, stopgap, changeable, or imaginary pie-in-the-sky type, like that envisaged by so-called social reformers and mundane philanthropists. The welfare work he proposed is of the highest caliber, and neither temporary nor insignificant. The ways to uplift others, already invented, being invented, and about to be invented by ordinary human beings according to their narrow considerations, will in no way profit anyone because they are all makeshift. Sri Mahaprabhu revealed the actual means for elevating others. Vedyam Vastavamatra Vastu, Shivadang Tapa Trayon Nulanam. If you don't know what that means, you're not studying the books properly, because it's a well-known quote from Srimad Bhagavatam. Distresses are the effect of a particular cause, and until the cause is terminated, the effect will remain. Unless the root of a banyan tree is destroyed, it will again sprout, even if one cuts down its trunk and branches thousands of times. The thousands of man-made proposals for social welfare are like an attempt to empty the ocean with one's bare hands. Even if thousands of people engage continuously in such an endeavor for thousands of yugas, they will never be successful. By doing so, they might cause a vast body of water to accumulate elsewhere. Similarly, we cannot empty the ocean of material suffering by our own strength. At most, we will simply succeed in transferring the problems elsewhere. Of course, by doing that, we can certainly deceive others and even ourselves. So this is the severe accusation. Who will dare to make such an accusation? That the bodily welfare work being carried out within ISKCON is deceiving others and ourselves. But actually it's deliberately meant to deceive others, that because the idea is that the unstated purpose is that actually we understand that bhakti is the highest, but people don't understand. So we'll engage them in this way. So it's meant to deceive them. But actually we deceive ourselves, because we start to, as I say, talk, act and think like a mundane person. We, instead of approaching people and telling them that Krishna consciousness is the solution to all problems, we meet them and say, please help with that. We're doing great work by feeding the poor, opening hospitals, and so on. So another quote from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. There are so many. To have faith in the holy name is so very rare that we may leave it out of consideration. If we had faith even in Nama Bhas, the most dimly perceived name, we would never have said that succoring the victims of floods is better than kirtan and prachar, singing and preaching about God, or that freeing the country from famines or the opening of hospitals is better than preaching devotion to God. Hundreds of famines can be alleviated not only by Nama Abhas, but even by Nama Parad, offensive taking of the name. So, of course, no one in ISKCON is saying that opening hospitals is better than preaching devotion to God, but by their actions, they're saying, because it's a huge effort to set up a hospital. And setting up a hospital with the same endeavor and funds, one could promote the preaching of the holy name. Now, the idea of running hospitals by devotees, and then people are in distress, and then you preach to them, you look after them, and the employees are devotees. Well, maybe it's not a bad idea. We find in there's a book by Srila Prabhupada called The Message of Godhead, in which he gives recommendations that factory owners can call their workers together to chant Hare Krishna and give them all prasadam. But as I understand it, that's for people who already have factories. It's not that Prabhupada's recommending you. That people who are devotees invest their funds to set up factories so people can work in a factory and chant Hare Krishna. I mean, just like the Bhaktivedanta Hospital was set up spending huge amounts of money, which could have been used for... Well, if you want to do social welfare work, why not do it the way that Prabhupada said, that set up varnashram communities, which is an all-around solution. As far as... Okay, seeing as I'm saying this, I'll say it here. I have some doubts about the Bhaktivedanta Hospital in as much as the money is collected for money. They keep on collecting money, and all they have devotees, like full time engaged in collection for it. I wonder, because you know, so many hospitals are set up in India for profit, and then why is this one collecting funds all over the world? In America, I find that there are so many disciples of a certain guru within ISKCON who they all donate regularly to the Bhaktivedanta Hospital and eye camps and this and that, and I guess they feel they're obligated to do so. But why? That's part of their devotional service. But why not donate for distributing books, setting up varnashram community, directly activities that Prabhupada recommended, and directly devotional? So you're bringing people to Prabhupada's movement and directing them to engage in some bodily welfare work. And how they're collecting so much money. The midday meals also. A devotee recently wrote to me who was connected with the congregation of a certain temple that runs this midday meals program. And he had been asked to canvass within his company for the sponsorship of the midday meals. So it seems that they're going on more and more widely, collecting more and more money. They could be collecting money, like I say, directly for Krishna consciousness, but they're engaging people who have come to Krishna consciousness in activities which are not Krishna conscious. I mean, they have to approach their company members and say, look, we're feeding the poor, we're building up the nation, we're helping poor children. They don't go and get money from them. Instead of preaching to their company members, or instead of engaging them in raising funds for Krishna consciousness, they're engaged in raising funds they are engaged in collecting funds for bodily welfare work. That's what they do. I mean, that's what they say. They may have the understanding that actually it's all spiritual, but what they are engaged in, what they actually say and do, is that we are collecting funds to help people so they can get a better future, and we're helping to develop the nation like this. I don't know. I mean, there's so many things to say. Well, just one. At the Bhaktivedanta Hospital in Bombay, I have some objection. Srila Prabhupada, he objected that at the Yoga Pit in Mayapur, the temple of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's birthplace, After Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's departure, one of his disciples made a temple honoring Bhaktivinoda Thakur at the entrance to the Yogapitha. And Prabhupada said that, he said, that's disrespectful. They made him like the doorkeeper. So they might bear that in mind, that Prabhupada's murti is right there in the right in the entrance. So Prabhupada didn't much approve of that. Oh, that thing about collecting funds. We always used to hear this, that the that Madhu Pandit had set up the Akshay Patra program for fund collection. We don't hear about that so much, but the idea that he has become, of course, I guess it would be difficult to prove this, but he made this he's clearly moving around huge amounts of money, and it's said that that money has largely been generated from the Akshay Patra program, that they say that it costs so much money to feed people, but actually it, one plate costs this much, but actually it costs less, and so they collect a lot more money than they need to for the actual food distribution, and in this way they're generating money. So there's definitely a lot of money floating around. And whether it's all going to Krishna conscious purposes or for the purpose that it's said to be collected for, I don't know. It's open to question. Eye camps, another thing that's collected for all over the world. Eye camps are held by devotees or members of ISKCON like once a year or something in Vrindavan, and they collect all year all over the world on the basis of that. I don't mind, but I don't know how it can cost so much money that they have to go on collecting and collecting and collecting in the name of eye camps. Once I was in Bahrain, and I was told that a certain a doctor who was a disciple of a certain guru in our movement, whose followers organized these eye camps, I was told that he'd recently moved to Bahrain. So then I met him, and the first thing he said to him is, "Oh, we've opened a new eye camp in Varshan." That's the first thing he said to me, like, you know, like that is what all his devotional aspirations are about. You know, not like we're distributing books, or but we open a new eye camp. So I said to him, yeah, so all those people now, they'll all be watching TV very nicely. And he laughed, and he had to agree. One of my disciples, who's a doctor, he went to one of those, he participated in one of those eye camps once. He said he'd never do it again because he was serving free tea. He didn't agree with that. Along with the eye camp, they had free tea for everyone. So that's said to be serving Vrajvasis, but I don't, because it's done in the area of Vraja, but I don't, you know, is that the way to serve Vrajvasis? Is to help them unless you give them spiritual uplift. I mean, we shouldn't be in this sentimental mood that everyone who's a Vrajavasi, who's born in Vraja or lives in Vraja, is a perfect pure devotee. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur certainly didn't agree with that. And by their activities, you can, you know, watching TV. And one of my godbrothers who's lived in Vrindavan for many years, he's quite convinced, knowing. He sent me once a list of some of the really horrible things that he knew certain Vrajvasis were doing. So we could also work to uplift their character by the regular process of devotional service. I'm getting a bit all over the place here. Say the Bhaktivedanta Hospital, it's serving devotees. A leading devotee at ISKCON in Juhu in Bombay told me that there's free treatment at the Bhaktivedanta Hospital for devotees, but only from Chopati, Pune, not for Juhu devotees. He said, why the sectarianism? I don't know if that's changed now. He told me that about 2 years ago. He said, we send our devotees to other hospitals where they, non-devotee hospitals where they treat us free. But I went to the Bhaktivedanta Hospital for a checkup once. They charged me 2,000 rupees and something. That was years ago. And then after that, I did checkups in other hospitals, and again they treat me free. So maybe they're under the impression that devotees are treated free. Well, some of them. So there's midday meals and Bhaktivedanta Hospital, eye camps. It's a bit nebulous because it's not being run in the name of ISKCON. So if anyone brings up any criticism, they say, well, it's not ISKCON. But everyone relates with it as being ISKCON. And like I say, people, due to their relationship with ISKCON, they're expected to donate for it or to offer to solicit donations for it. And we may say, well, that's just something on the side that some of our congregation are doing, but it's entered the ISKCON culture. And recently I saw brochures for two ISKCON projects for building temples in India, in which in both of them they included, along with the temple, hospital, school, old age home, as if it's, something that, that's what ISKCON does. The temple, there was like one paragraph about the temple, and then the rest of the brochure is about the hospital, the school. School doesn't mean Gurukul, it means teaching mundane subjects. So it's entered our culture. People think that, that's, our own devotees think, well, that's what ISKCON does. Have a temple, then you have to have a hospital. In one center, one devotee told me he was under tremendous pressure to start midday meals, and he didn't want to do it. So I'm not the only one who's against this. He didn't want to do it, but he was under tremendous pressure because he thought, it's what ISKCON does. Why don't you do it? So in this way, like I said, in that brochure, there was a small bit about the temple, and all the rest was about old age home, and hospital, and so you see that the directly spiritual part about the temple is gradually becoming less and less, and then the hospital becomes the main thing. Like with the Salvation Army, their directly religious activities have become less and less and less because it's much easier to go along with what people like rather than some higher ideal. So like this, schools and colleges. Srila Prabhupada is very clearly against mundane education, which is why he set up Gurukuls. But then, nowadays school in ISKCON, they proudly announce that our school is affiliated with the Cambridge Board, and we have in Mayapur.
One basketball competition.
Yeah, I tell you that. No, I told you that. That's coming up. We're proud to announce that our school is affiliated with the Cambridge Board. Why? Pride. That's in Mayapur. Right? People come to Mayapur and instead of getting education in Srimad Bhagavatam, they get education in how to be another mudha member of modern society. Oh, and they have little kirtan in the beginning and in the end, maybe. But the curriculum is mundane. Yeah, a few years ago, when I was visiting ISKCON Vrindavan, after the Mongol Arati, the Vice President made some announcements. One of the announcements he made was that our school basketball team has reached the semi-final of the UP State Championships. So we were all supposed to be, we're supposed to be enlivened by that. That this is not what Srila Prabhupada gave his blood to go to the West and preach so that we developed schools in Vrindavan for such mundane things. It's all the worst. I mean, it's bad enough anywhere, but in Vrindavan, it's where we should be encouraging the spiritual culture. It's a completely mundane. Now the idea is that, well, you see, people, they like us, and but not necessarily, because after all, pretty much every Hindu organization in India runs some schools, and so, you know, people don't particularly like us for that. Even the prasadam distribution, what it's called, that may not necessarily endear us to people. Some years in Armenia, which is a country in the former Soviet Union, devotees were distributing to the poor and needy for several years. They were distributing food for several years, and then one day there was a tremendous attack on our movement by some hoodlums, and they came to a temple and severely beat up the devotees. I was in Russia at the time. It came on the news in Russia on the TV. Covered in blood, and they smashed up the temple completely. And you would have thought that the people in general would have been supportive, have come out in support of us, because we'd done so much public welfare activity. But no one came out in our support, because, you know, Armenians have a very strong sense of national identity, and people didn't like that we were trying to introduce some new religion, so that practically our movement it never recovered from that, and we don't have any, our movements, which was centered around food distribution to people from the poorer section of society, that was like the main thing, food for life. But our movement has never recovered from that attack. So I'm just saying that it's not necessarily true that we do gain public support. And it can become a liability, because people expect you to do it, and then if you don't do it, then if you don't keep up this, you become trapped in doing that. I know in Bombay they made that school, and now they wanted to stop it at some point, but then the parents of the children, they wouldn't allow it. They made so much protest. So now they have to go to all the trouble of collecting huge amounts of money and setting up a school elsewhere outside the temple compound, because they realize that it's of no benefit whatsoever to the temple and just takes up unnecessary space. And the children, they don't become devotees. After going through the whole school, they just because the education is not to make them devotees per se. So it's like a case of the story of you lose your caste and you're still hungry. The brahmana, he begged food from a low caste person, and in doing, because he was so hungry, and he lost his caste by doing so. But the low caste person who fed him could only give him a handful to eat. So he lost his caste and he remained hungry. So we think we're getting some advantage, but we become doubly disadvantaged. Now, I'm not against feeding the poor. I'm not like, you know, totally against it. We shouldn't do it. But there are ways to do it which doesn't compromise our integrity. Just like, that's my claim, that the midday meals program, it compromises our integrity by promoting that, making fun, you know, a whole sub-organization within the organization, collecting funds in the name of building up the nation, helping children to get a good future, which is actually against our philosophy, or the philosophy that Srila Prabhupada taught us. So, examples of poor feeding programs that I, well, I'm speaking now, who am I, but anyway, whoever wants to listen, they can listen, that I think are very good. I'm pretty sure it's still going on. In Australia, I believe it was in Melbourne or Sydney, I can't remember, but every night they would, from the restaurant, whatever was left over, they have the restaurant at the temple, they would distribute it like 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night out the back of the temple, and, destitute people would come and they'd give them prasada. So that's good. In Melbourne, at ISKCON, I'm told that they have a program that whoever comes to the temple, they get all day long. They give them a full plate of prasadam. They don't ask them to give a donation. So that's very good. In Los Angeles, 3 or 4 times a week, they take the whatever's left over from the restaurant. They go down to one area of the town. They set up a table. People know they're coming at a certain time every time. So people who destitute, they come, and while they distribute prasad, they do kirtan. It's very open, they're devotees, and like this. So these are very good. There's also a program in London called not Food for Life, called Hare Krishna Food for All. So it's just a little bit different name, but it gives a different connotation, food for all instead of food for life. In other words, it's not just aimed at the poor, but it's meant for everyone. So they have a storefront, and it's like a free restaurant. And they're very openly devotees, and people come, and they have kirtan and like this. So... I'm not fanatically against distributing prasadam to the poor, but of course Srila Prabhupada also said that it should be distributed to everyone. Everyone is spiritually poor, so if we're going to distribute prasad, why marry that concept to that of poor feeding and make that a major initiative of our movement? Distribute prasadam widely to everyone. Everyone needs prasadam. It's not just the poor. Now, getting back to that, this specific question by which I came to narrate all these things today, that Kshatriyas, one of their works is, one of their duties is activities for public welfare. That's true, but the midday meals program is not a Kshatriya program. One of the main facets of being a Kshatriya is that you never beg anything from anyone for any reason. Kshatriya never begs. He levies taxes which he uses for the welfare of the people. So Kshatriya welfare work, the kings, the leaders of the society, actual Kshatriyas, are supposed to do that. They're not supposed to beg money. So if you're begging money from the public, yeah, that disqualifies you from being a kshatriya. So you can't say it's a kshatriya activity. Now, why then am I not in favor of this kshatriya project? Well, in concept, in the beginning I said, yes, it's a good idea, but because it's following this midday meals track, I say that although the idea is theoretically good, the implementation is wrong. They haven't understood what the mission is. The kshatriyas are supposed to assist the brahmanas. So if the idea is like the kshatriyas are assisting the work of the main pure brahminical work of ISKCON by fighting law cases to help and this and that, but then this assumes that ISKCON is on track and the kshatriyas are helping. But my proposition, which is no doubt controversial, is that ISKCON isn't on track. So if you help that, you're not really helping anything. Srila Prabhupada always said about Varnashram that the first thing is to get the brahmana order. And then the others can follow, because if the head is not in order, even if you have a healthy body, if the head is not in order, then the whole functioning becomes useless or disarranged. So, still the need is there to get the head in order. Because I've given some examples and I'll give some more. The best is yet to come in this lecture. Of how things are not philosophically in order in our movement. So to assist the movement as it presently stands shows this, means that the Kshatriya initiative is not going to work. We're still at the stage of needing to get the Brahmana order in proper shape. So, like this midday meals thing, I've noted some serious reservations I have about it. But our leaders have approved this program. A presentation was made to the GBC about this year, it was all approved. And at regional meetings, when it was here in India, when it stated that, you know, distributing biscuits to the flood-stricken people and leaders, it was a leaders' meeting, and everyone's clapping. And so my contention is that the brahmanas need to be put in order. Let me say something else first. Now, some other examples. There are many of how I perceive that our leaders are not properly situated in understanding and implementing Srila Prabhupada's teachings, is that in the famous incident, 9/11, when the World Trade Center came tumbling down for whatever reason, said to be because of some airplanes flying into it, into two of the towers, and one of the towers just came down without any apparent reason, that there was a huge outpouring of public sympathy for the firemen, many of them who were killed in trying to combat the fires within that building. So one of our GBC members, who was also a temple president, arranged from his temple community a collection to help the firemen, which, if you don't see the ambiguity in that with what Prabhupada's teachings are all about, then you, my dear friend, are a victim of the very syndrome that I'm talking about. Another example came on the internet quite a few years ago, maybe 9 or 10 years ago, a report of the first ISKCON golf championship, which was held in California on Gaur Purnima Day. And it gave a report. This is on the Chakra website, which you may remember was prominent in ISKCON at one point. So the report came up, and the report how there were several ex-temple presidents there, and we're very grateful that our one GBC member also came. He couldn't spend much time because he was quite busy, and but he played a few holes with us. So these are just some examples of how those who are the leaders seem to be very much misleading, or themselves not properly situated. Now, one job the kshatriyas are supposed to see that everyone follows their duties properly. So, if the kshatriya initiative can get the, instead of going along with the things that the leaders shouldn't be doing, is if they can get them to do what they should be doing, that would be a great job. To rectify the rot within our society. I don't how exactly kshatriyas are supposed to discipline brahmanas, and that would require some research because they're not allowed to physically punish them. Maybe kshatriyas could withdraw their financial support or something. I don't know exactly how it would be done. And how it's to be done in the modern age also is within ISKCON, that's also. I mean, actually, it's establishing actual kshatriyas, it's difficult to think how that could be done in the modern age because a kshatriya is a king. He's not the CEO or head of a department. He's a king. Which are not in a democratic society, that's not allowed to have kings. And any absolute dictator, they're subject to be invaded by America for having absolute, like it happened with Saddam Hussein. He was a king, you could say. Where there is absolute king-like rule, well, the king of Saudi Arabia is still there. He's a king in the sense that what he makes the law. But that's not considered very good in the modern age. How would you have kshatriyas in India or America, which are democratic countries? It requires some research actually. I mean, or prayer to see how you could actually have kshatriyas. It's not just administrators, but administrators with power. And power comes from physical strength and fighting skills. That's the power. It's the power of force, of the power to punish. That's where the manifestation of kshatriya power comes from. Ultimately, the power comes from Krishna. But anyway, if the kshatriyas endeavor in ISKCON could be for getting it back on course, that would be good. So there's no doubt that ISKCON has changed a lot. The ISKCON communications endeavor to change the movement has been successful. But again, it's a case of having lost your caste and remaining hungry, because in the basic activities of temple worship are going on often in a very poor way to the standards that Prabhupada gave. Harinam Sankirtan is going on here and there, not much. In many places, book distribution is not much promoted. In the particular group that within India that very much promotes the hospital, midday meals, eye camps, and so on, there's not that much emphasis within their group on book distribution, although between them they do that also. But whereas previously our movement, as Prabhupada writes in one of his purports, our movement is centered on distribution of books. But when we think of that particular group within ISKCON, we're more likely to think of hospitals and midday meals and eye camps and distribution of books. So ISKCON has changed, and my contention is that it's become more mundane and it's getting worse. And we are inured to that. Inured means there's something bad, you get used to it, so that you just think that it's normal. Just like to give an example, this is just from less than a month ago. One of my disciples who's temporarily living in France with her husband there told me that in the course of a conversation with an initiated devotee there, she had said something disparaging about Sai Baba, at which this initiated devotee became extremely angry and he thought that she was very wrong in criticizing Sai Baba. Now, if at all we have studied Srila Prabhupada's books and tried to understand the mood of his preaching, then we can understand, or if we actually lived in ISKCON in the time when Srila Prabhupada was present, and for a few years after that, we should understand that for someone who's an initiated devotee within ISKCON to have any good opinion about Sai Baba means there's something seriously wrong. But maybe even more seriously wrong than that is that when I heard this, I wasn't in the slightest bit surprised. You see? I'm not bluffing. And we become so used to hearing about all these various deviations that we just think there's nothing extraordinary about it. Just like a few days previous to that incident, which happened in Croatia, this lady devotee telling me about her experiences with the initiated fan of Sai Baba. I mean, the ISKCON initiated person who was a fan of Sai Baba. I gave a lecture in ISKCON in Zagreb, which is the capital of Croatia. And at the end of the lecture, a person who seemed he was a newcomer, seemed like he was coming for the first time, or seemed very new to our movement. He asked a question. He said, "Well, in my childhood, I was abused," and he asked how to get over that. So afterward, Gokul Chandra Prabhu, who was present in that lecture, noted to me privately after the lecture that, you see, he said that I was abused in my childhood and no one was surprised. It's become like a normal thing. Not that it's accepted as a good thing, but it's become so commonplace that if someone says I was abused in my childhood, then people just, you know, they don't become surprised because they just think it's normal. In other words, something which is actually abominable, horrible, has become so common that no one's surprised and they think it's normal. So, if in our movement we're not surprised when someone tells us that an initiated devotee within ISKCON becomes angry when Sai Baba is criticized, you know, there's something. In human society, if child abuse is so common that it doesn't arouse any surprise, there's something seriously wrong in society. So similarly, in the ISKCON society, if people have favorable disposition towards Sai Baba, there's something seriously wrong. So that's the point I'm making there. And there are so many things like that, that years ago we would have been shocked, it would have been unthinkable within ISKCON, which are just normal nowadays. One thing which is very, very touchy, very sensitive, and people will get upset if, I guess some people will hear this on the internet. It's very sensitive because one of the most, there's a book written by one of the, actually it's ghostwritten, means it was written by someone else on his behalf, written by one of the, probably the most popular leader within ISKCON today. Now that book, I can't help thinking that if you'd shown it to Srila Prabhupada, he would not have been at all pleased. Because there are pictures of all these Mayavadis and mundane people, famous mundane welfare workers. And there are a few pictures of Prabhupada there also. And it describes how he met all these different mundane people. And there's not a bad word about any of them. The people that Prabhupada, if he spoke about them at all, would criticize them. And speaks about how he met Prabhupada. And it doesn't really say that Prabhupada's, you know, I thought it was going to come to, I read the book and I thought it was very well written by the woman who was paid to write it. Very readable. So I thought we were going to get to the point, and I met Prabhupada, and Prabhupada opened my eyes, and he made me realize that all these people were rascals and cheaters, which is the word that Prabhupada regularly used for them. But no such thing. It's just like in each time he'd go to one guru, and then he'd realize this is not my path, and then he realizes when he met Prabhupada, actually sometime later, that this is my path. In other words, that everyone has their path, and this is my path, and there are all the different paths, and you can choose this path or that path or any other path. And at the end of the book, he says that now, having come to Prabhupada, now I'm engaged in helping with hospitals and feeding children and eye camps. In other words, the message is that what he got from Prabhupada was to have hospitals, eye camps, and feeding people. And the message to his followers is that this is what that's his life. That's what is central to his life. So, as I see it, there are serious problems with that. And serious problems with that, you know, from that group, then they were never as enthusiastic to distribute Prabhupada's books as they are to distribute this book, which even if anyone read that book for hundreds of thousands of times, they'd never even get the idea that you're supposed to surrender to Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The purpose of life is to surrender to Krishna. They'd never even get the idea. One godbrother told me that he started reading it, but he stopped when he came to the erotic part. Another godbrother told me that his feeling was that some erotic or almost erotic scenes, that it's not the duty of a sannyasi to write about such things. So I see there's another example. I mean, I just can't imagine what Prabhupada's response would have been if he saw that book. But our movement has changed. It's not for the better. And if we start to talk about it, there could be so many things. I mean, another of my GPC godbrothers told me that ISKCON Mayapur is run by a mafia, and he gave an example of how he had to pay a bribe to the devotee who was supposed to do some official work for him, and he complained to one of the leaders of ISKCON Mayapur, who just said, how much did he ask from you? And he told the amount, and then he pulled out and said, he knew the mafia was going on, but he was just supportive of it, that's all. So nowadays, at the present time in India, there's a huge outcry against government corruption. And although it would be very difficult to prove, I'm fairly sure that there's a lot of corruption going on in ISKCON India also, because the leaders are not, you know, they're just given a free hand, and the whole, there's not any close checking of them, and the whole culture of the country is riddled with corruption. So do we just presume that everyone who comes to ISKCON is a complete saint and they have all this money coming in, and what's going on? Like I say, it's difficult to prove, but there are serious grounds to consider that, especially when we see that in many temples they're interested in collection, so much so that in many temples of ISKCON in India, preacher means someone who goes out and collects money. It doesn't mean someone who tries to get people to change their life and surrender to Krishna. And in fact, we see in many temples, they don't seem to be even slightly concerned about preaching to people to surrender and give their life to Krishna. And if anyone does that, they object to that, because it disturbs their whole ongoing business. So, and there are so many things. In many cases, when devotees have problems, they're more likely to be counseled on the basis of mundane psychology than by reference to Shastra. One thing that Srila Prabhupada, he wrote that I'm very afraid that after I leave, the deity worship standard will be diminished. But it is. It's become accepted within our society. People who join, they don't even know that you're supposed to be a Brahmin initiated devotee to worship the deity. They never heard of such a thing. And they make they make their own reasoning that, well, bhakti is the main thing, Brahmin initiation isn't important. So the standards have in many cases very much diminished. So that's a serious problem. Recently when I was in America, a temple president told me that most of the newcomers to our movement nowadays, they don't read Srila Prabhupada's books. They're not encouraged to do so. And actually, they don't like to, because Prabhupada's books, what is said in Prabhupada's books is not what's preached within the movement, and people don't like to hear so many things that are in Prabhupada's books. For instance, that women are less intelligent than men. To say that is practically banned in ISKCON now, although it's a point that Srila Prabhupada makes many times. Of course, that point in particular should be understood very carefully and not used as a stick to bash women, but at the same time it is a point that Prabhupada made many times. So people don't like to read Prabhupada's books because our devotees don't believe in what's in them, and they don't want to speak on these things because, well, I don't know why. I guess they don't believe what Prabhupada says. In some places the idea is that it's openly promoted that, well, Prabhupada's books, they're too difficult to understand, so we have other books by other people, by other members of ISKCON. Better you give these to people, and they can understand them more easily. And there's a whole big sub-movement going on within ISKCON in India in which they're not allowed to read. Actually, there are two of them. There are two of going on under two groups. I mean, it means a lot of people are being brought into ISKCON being told that they're not allowed to read Prabhupada's books until they get permission. They have to read other books, and they distribute these other books. So I'm not saying that other books are necessarily wrong, but to say that you shouldn't read Prabhupada's books, it's just unimaginable what Prabhupada, you know, how angry Prabhupada would be. But I guess they don't care. Yeah, yeah. Some devotees, from here recently visited one of these temples which is supposed to be preaching and very successful, making many new members, which is the center of this movement, that you have to read other books and not Prabhupada's books. And they saw in the bookstall there weren't Prabhupada's books. And they asked, and there were just all kinds of books. And then they asked for Prabhupada's books. They had to look around, and there were just one or two hidden away somewhere. So those devotees were going there. There was, because this center offers training in how to preach. So they were going there for that. And then they just left. They don't want this kind of training. They don't need this sophisticated training of how not to give Prabhupada's books to others. By the way, I'm also criticized. Sometimes people say that, you see, I'm engaging my disciples in distributing my books. That's true, that my disciples do distribute my books. They are meant to supplement to supplement the mission of Srila Prabhupada. They're meant for distribution also. But my answer to that is that yes, it's true. But that if you take my average disciple and compare to the average devotee within ISKCON, you'll find that on average, my disciples read Prabhupada's books and distribute Prabhupada's books significantly more than do others. So it's not that I'm promoting that my books are not Prabhupada's books, but rather as supplements. Like the Beginner's Guide for Krishna Consciousness, that's by far the most distributed of my books, and that's to by reading that puts in written form many of the instructions that Prabhupada verbally imparted for practicing Krishna consciousness. So anyway, that's another discussion. But certainly Prabhupada wanted books to be written by his disciples. He criticized the Gauriya Math for not having produced their own books. They're still selling the books of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati only. So he criticized them for that. So, what do we get from all this? Well, either ISKCON in general there's something very wrong, or I am very wrong. And I invite you to consider. That's, is my perspective simply hypercritical, or are there serious, things like GBC members playing in the ISKCON golf competition on Gaur Purnima. I mean, any day is bad enough, but on Gaur Purnima day, when you're supposed to be glorifying Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there's not something wrong with that? And the GBC member is not he's not questioned about that. A few years ago, one GBC member was, one of my godbrothers forced him to make a public apology. Forced him means that, you see, this GBC member had accused this godbrother of using astrology to seduce women, and he said that there are at least 13 women we can call as evidence for this, and this devotee, who's an astrologer, he, you know, his whole reputation was within ISKCON was spoiled, and his way of life was, people didn't want to come to him, so eventually he, in one of the few cases of some justice actually being, I mean, generally you can't get justice. But he actually, he said, okay, you have 13 women, bring one. Tell me one. So like this, he kept on challenging him to bring evidence that he'd actually done this. So eventually that GBC member had to make a public apology and apologized to the GBC for having... He even stated this in Mayapur during a GBC meeting. He lied to the whole GBC when it practically came to. And so they gave an apology, and life went on as usual. He continued as a GBC. I mean, shouldn't the GBC have thought to remove him for engaging in the nastiest, basest politics against character assassination? Because he didn't like that devotee, so he didn't have any actual complaint. Actually, he didn't like the... anyway, I won't get it, but... I mean, these things... there are serious problems. So people may say, yeah, I'm hypercritical, although it could also be said that it's just realistic. And then why do I... and then some people will say that, well, you see, that shows everything is all wrong, so Ritvikism is the answer. Or join the Gauriya Math. But that doesn't necessarily prove the case of, you know, different people say, well, it's because of this, it's because of that. Why don't you start your own movement? But these are not necessarily the answers. I mean, the Ritvikvadis, they're quite active in scanning. They go through all lectures that are put on the internet, and they'll probably love this one. But the fact that there are problems in ISKCON doesn't prove their case. And the fact that, you know, Ritvikvadis are also shown to be corrupt, and in so many problems, and there are factions among them and all kinds of things. I'm not supporting that as a solution. Although, which is one reason that, you know, I've been hesitant to say all these things, but like I say, people should know at least where I stand. So is it not hypocritical for me? Why do I stay in ISKCON? I sometimes wonder myself, but Prabhupada said, he said not to leave. So that's a very powerful instruction. Of course, sometimes I feel that I didn't really... I can't really leave ISKCON, that ISKCON left me, so to speak, because I'm just doing the same things and saying the same things that I did when I first joined, but the movement changed. I didn't change. So I didn't leave ISKCON. ISKCON left me. I mean, all my friends are within ISKCON. That's one thing. I guess principles higher than friendships. But then it has to be seen, as my life is meant to be for the service of Srila Prabhupada, could I actually serve Prabhupada's mission better by going outside of ISKCON and of the body that is of the body of ISKCON? I'm not convinced that I could do so. I could better serve it. For all the wrong things going on, still ISKCON's really the only hope for spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. So to try to get ISKCON in order is a better proposition. It's not so easy. I mean, here in Salem, I'm trying to, with the cooperation of you all, especially led by Gokul Chandra Prabhu, I'm trying to set up just what we might call a normal ISKCON center, or what a normal ISKCON center used to be. That everyone has to rise early in the morning. You have the full temple program, and the focus is on book distribution and bringing people to Krishna consciousness. So, just trying to do all of this, but it's. It is difficult to train, even though we have, you know, there's like this little space in this small town here, and in other places also, some devotees, you could say within the broader ISKCON, they're my followers, But it is difficult to train people within the present ISKCON society when there are all these Mayavad and Sahajiya influences. I mean, just like, for instance, I mean, there's thousands of things you could say. Someone you're bringing in new to Krishna consciousness, and they go to Mayapur, and on the bookstall they pick up the book, The Glories of Radharani. And, you know, they're just new in Krishna consciousness. And if they get that, you know, what conception are they going to have of Krishna consciousness? One of my disciples told me, he saw one of the devotees who had gone to Mayapur, just a new person. He just told him, look, better you don't read it. Please read Bhagavad Gita as it is. And he took that book from him. Otherwise, he'd be lost in, you know, in the dream clouds of imaginary Prem Bhav. So why such books are being produced and offered to the public? That's not the example of our acharyas. Prabhupada hardly talked about Radha. He was the topmost devotee of Radha, but it's a very intimate subject. But just to bring it out in public to everyone is Prakriti Sahajiya influence. So with all these Mayavad and Sahajiya and mundane influences all around, it's difficult to train people because, you know, you don't want to tell people when they first come that there's this problem, that problem, that problem, and then they just get completely discouraged. But then if you don't tell them, then, you know, they think, well, they go to ISKCON Vrindavan, for instance, and they see and hear so many strange things, and they think, well, it must be the right thing to do because it's ISKCON Vrindavan, for instance. So, how to correct the situation? Who will accept these points? I've several times mentioned to various leaders of our society that, of course, it's not my idea. It's been floating around to have orders, like in the Catholic Church, they have orders. That means there are different subgroups, which they have a certain amount of autonomy, but they all offer allegiance to the Pope in Rome. So something like that, we could have separate orders where we don't necessarily have to go along with them. We're a little different. That might be the solution. It's not really a solution if things are off, if they're wrong, but at least it would give us some approved space to do what we're doing. How to rectify the situation? It seems very difficult. It seems that if at all things are going to get better, and then they're going to have to get worse first, because there's no feeling in our movement even that things are seriously wrong. And rather thinking that, well, things are right and things get worse and worse. And it seems like we really have to get a good kick from, just like the Karmis, when are they going to wake up? And they need a good kick from Maya to understand that their materialistic plans are all useless. So that maybe the situation in our movement also, you don't have to translate for all of this for all these new people. I have attempted to go through the regular channels to rectify some things which I found frustrating. I became infamous a few years ago for my open attacks. Open means via email, which went out all over the internet, on one of my godbrothers who was, he's passed away now, a popular guru within our movement and populist, you could say. He was known as the mystic guru. So I had some severe exception to some of the things he was writing in his books. So I did try to, you know, behind the scenes, going through the process, discussing with him, having a GBC monitored mediation and all this, but nothing worked. So I tried coming out publicly and just blasting that this is all bogus, and that didn't work either. So I'm not sure what to do. I mean, you could. There are devotees who like regularly. They're out there on the internet expressing their perspectives of what's wrong, but I'd rather write books and for a long-term solution. The, you know, internet advocacy doesn't seem to be that effective. I'm not saying it's all wrong. Just related with that, I was trying to go through some GBC process of rectifying in these books there are some really wild things written. So I was called to meet this godbrother of mine who was making these wild statements in his books, which were widely distributed within ISKCON and to the public. So I was called to Mayapur at the time of the GBC meeting, and I was asked, well, would you like to join the GBC, the plenary session, all the GBC members together? You can join it for a few minutes and then you can go off and meet with him. So I said, okay, and I came in and I saw there's a huge, long table with all the GBC members and others present there. And I saw there were mostly men, but a few women there also. So they're like, you know, there'd be like two sannyasis and one woman sitting, and three or four sannyasis, mostly sannyasis, and then some women. I thought, well, this is a bit strange, you know. There's sannyasis and women all sitting at the table. So I went and took a spot to sit, and not next to any woman. And I just looked to my left and I saw there was a painting. It was an abstract painting, which means impersonalism. And I saw the title, I couldn't work out what's it supposed to be. It's an abstract. And I saw the title and it was like the name of some place in Navadvip, Dham. And when I looked at it a bit more, I could work out that it was like some, in a very abstract way, is supposed to be some scene in Navadvip Dham, but abstract style. Which, like I say, it's impersonalistic. And then I looked all around the room and I saw the rooms full of all these abstract paintings. So then the incoming chairman of the GBC started his speech. So this is the first speech in the GBC meeting of the first speech in the meeting of the whole year. And for about the first 10 minutes, he spoke about some Kami movie that he'd been to. So, you know, first I walked in and saw the men and women all mixed up. Then I saw the abstract paintings. And then a meeting of all the leaders is supposed to discuss how to promote the Sankirtan movement. And there's this telling about some Monty Python movie that he'd been to. I just thought this is very, very strange. When that devotee who was writing those strange books, when he passed away, the GBC gave a condolence or obituary or something like that, and they noted especially one of his great contributions was his books. And I was on a campaign to say that his books are bogus. All kinds of really weird things in there. So then I thought, well, that's, you know, that just shows our movement's a Sahajiya movement, because if they're praising these books, which are completely bogus, then what is that? Recently, I've been invited to a leaders' meeting in which different leaders from ISKCON are supposed to meet and discuss the proposed proposals for the GBC and give their input in Mayapur just before the GBC meeting. So I appreciate that because it's been for many years that we just have to accept whatever the GBC say. They can just make rules without discussing with anyone. And you know, it's just like overnight in the year 2000, they changed the whole social ethos of ISKCON by implementing the Women's Rights Bill or something like this, without discussing with the members of ISKCON who it affects. So I appreciate that, but for me it's too late. If 10 years ago I might have gone, but now. I told the devotee who's organizing that meeting that I don't want to go because I don't agree with the idea of sitting around discussing with women, which is part of the ethos in ISKCON today. Whereas Prabhupada, he was not for women having leadership roles. I mean, he wrote against it several times in his books. He never made any women GBCs or temple presidents. With one exception, in the very early days, he made a woman a temple president. So, I disagree that what to speak of sannyasis, any men should sit around for hours discussing with women. I mean, I'm not against women, but I speak with them a little bit. But women should discuss with men means their fathers, their intimate relatives. But the idea that men and women, they're just all mix up and speak so many things, I'm against it. I don't see that that's part of the culture that we're supposed to be instituting. So that's one reason I told him I didn't want to go. But the another reason is that I think it's, like I say, it's too far gone for the ideas that I have. I have means it's my understanding of what Srila Prabhupada taught us, and it's demonstrably closer to what Prabhupada said than a lot of the things that are going on now today. So I don't think anything at this point is going to change. Like I say, you can say this is not right, that's not right, but if at all things are going to get better, it's going to get worse. It's going to have to get worse first. So then why am I speaking all these things anyway? Well, because people ask me. I should at least make it clear to those who are coming to me what my position is. And if they want, because people are asking me to be their disciples. So they should know what I stand for. Otherwise, they may be disappointed later, or I may be disappointed later if they don't like the stance that I've made. It may seem, like I said, I'm hypercritical of so many sincere devotees. Yeah, I'm sure so many devotees are sincere, but in who are doing many of the things that I'm criticizing here or saying that are wrong. But what is the actual criterion of sincerity? I mean, there are many Christians in this country who are very sincere about converting people to Hindus to Christianity, and when they get baptized they have to one of the things they have to do is publicly rip up their pictures of Krishna and various Hindu gods and stamp on the pictures. So the Christians are very sincere, and they think that they're doing something good for the people. But now I'm not saying that our devotees who are doing midday meals and all that are in the same category as those Christians. But the point is that sincerity or earnestness is not in and of itself the prime. Well, actually, the The prime earnestness and sincerity are not necessarily exactly the same thing. The earnestness, that should be first of all for the right thing, because you can be very earnest and determined and dedicated to doing something, but if it's not the right thing, then it's the wrong thing. And even if we open many temples and we have many people joining and so many things, lots of money, lots of public appreciation, but if for any reason Srila Prabhupada is not pleased, then it's all useless. That's all. And I can only say it's my opinion, because I'm not saying I'm the arbiter of the truth, but that much in our society is not what Prabhupada actually wanted us to do. And speaking this lecture with the idea of putting it on the internet, I doubt if it'll make much effect. It's not that, that this lecture is, everyone's going to get now we've got to change this, make it better. There may be the effect that some people will criticize me for being overly critical of others, or some people may say, yes, that was very good. And, after a short time it'll be forgotten. Another thing, I've made several attempts to go through the GBC. Somehow or other, it's all ended. It's very frustrating. So, previously, to make such statements, one would have been smashed by the powers that be. Nowadays, it's more likely to be ignored, or politely acknowledged, or maybe, some, yes, we are very concerned, but I don't expect that making this public will affect any great change. But like I say, it's for those who are approaching me, at least to them they can be clear that I perceive that there are many things, that our movement's basically off the track and not properly following Srila Prabhupada. I know this is very discouraging. It may sound very discouraging, but the good news is that you still can follow Srila Prabhupada, and whatever anyone does to change this way and that way, Prabhupada's books are still there. Prabhupada, he knew, he put his books out. He said that even if everyone goes away, my books are there, and by reading the books, people will again take it up. So, you can follow. And at least here, again, I'm saying that as I perceive it, here we are following Krishna consciousness and Srila Prabhupada in a manner that is actually conducive for spiritual advancement. It's not mixed up with mundane psychology, mundane welfare, mundane welfare work, or if you say that the midday meals, etc., is not mundane welfare work, at least it's presented as if it's mundane welfare work. So it's a close approximation of mundane welfare work, and where it begins or ends is subject to discussion. So at least here we're trying to make that, as I say, make that ethos in which we can practice Krishna consciousness as Srila Prabhupada wanted us to, without making various changes this way, that way, or the other way. And we find that at least some people are appreciating that and finding that there's a vibrant, uplifting spiritual atmosphere here, and we find that especially for festivals, more and more devotees are coming fairly long distances to join in the festivals and rather attend here than in the center in their own town, because they find it a better spiritual atmosphere. So, Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments on this? Like I say, this might elicit, when it goes on the internet, it might elicit some responses and this and that, and people may write to me. But I'm not much into having protracted arguments by email or on the internet, because I see it doesn't go anywhere. So I'm stating my case, and like I say, I don't intend to get into a nitty-gritty defense of every little point. Can't spend all my time getting these, like you get these email debates, they go on and on and on. At the end, no one changes their position anyway. So, what's the point? Yeah, anything? Better all have a big kirtan after this, which is what we mostly do here, a lot of kirtan, recover from all this. There are so many things that can be said. One of my disciples, he said, after being to a leader's meeting, a 3 days leader meeting, he said, I need about 2 weeks to recover from it. He feels so contaminated by the association of people. I went to one of them once, this area we ended. Were you there? I think in Bangalore. After some time, I just said, hey, let's have a kirtan, because let's try and make a spiritual atmosphere here. It was just all so mundane and arguing and this and that. And so I did a kirtan, which no one could refuse, but no one was very enthusiastic for it either. So, yeah, I remember in the years ago, in the BTG, printed from America, there are so many things that a devotee wrote an article about, said, oh, I just attended another boring BTG editors meeting. But why boring? I mean, it should be the most enlivening thing. So, presenting a magazine that's meant for the re-spiritualization of human society. You're saying it was boring. It was like, so. I mean, if you start, there's no end to the strange things that have entered our movement. And it's not just me saying, by the way. It's not my own personal trip. Even, you see, the GBC now, in any letter they send out, they always refer to women as Prabhu, whereas one of the most prominent and respected GBC members put on his, what do you call that, blog? When they speak something? Webcast?
Blog?
When it's spoken, it's also called a blog? Yeah, so he replied to this question, what do you think of calling women Prabhu? And he openly said, it's all nonsense. he's also saying that at least one of the things that's been introduced in our movement recently within the GBC is nonsense. So, at least on some issues, there are some things that people agree with. On that issue also, Harishori Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's servant over a period of a few years, said all the time he was with Prabhupada, he never once heard any Prabhupada or anyone else in ISKCON call women Prabhu. But nowadays, if you don't call them Prabhu, they become upset. It's considered to be a great crime by some people. So, anything? Yeah. In Guruvaya, they serve prasadam? In the temple itself? Mm-hmm. To the general public? Yeah?
That cooking, for example, if we do it in our temple, and then that cooking is done by machines.
In Guruvaya also, they cook with machines? No, it's cooked in the traditional method by brahmanas over fires. They've introduced steam cooking. Yeah, that's a good program. I've said several times to Gokul Chandra, but I also said just yesterday that it's an important thing we have to start, that people who come to, like in Udupi and Guruvayur, people, full meal prasad served to anyone who comes. So that's a good program. We should do that. And we see in Udupi, so many students go there daily. No one complains. They give them prasad. So we can do that. In Gainesville, in Florida, for many years they've been serving prasadam to the students there, midday. It was free, I believe, and now they do it at a very low price. And they generally have kirtan going on, they serve it on the lawn. So that's well appreciated. That's good.
What are the answers to those say that by Bhakti Vedanta Hospital
we are making devotees by this, by Bhakti Vedanta Hospital? Yeah, but again, it's like that. I quoted that about Bhaktisthan Saraswati. If he just, compromised his philosophy a bit, there'd be so many more people would come and join. But he didn't. So, if you compromise the philosophy a bit, so many more people will come, but they won't have a clear understanding of what bhakti is. So, some good things, all right, they may become vegetarian and chant Hare Krishna, but they won't get a proper understanding of the philosophy if it's not taught. It's a fact that if you just make things a little less strict, then people can come much more easily. But the problem is that the essence is lost. They'll become devotees and then they'll also want to go and open hospitals and approach people and tell people, you see, we're helping the poor, this, that and the other. Which is not our philosophy, to help people on the... as a prime activity of our movement to help people on the bodily level. That's very clear from this reply to the Andhra Pradesh Relief Committee. Prabhupada could have agreed, it was not a big thing to ask to have a collection. That's all they asked for, is a collection to help their activities. Prabhupada refused and said no. He practically told them that your whole idea is demoniac. Why is all this happening when Prabhupada's books are there? Well, I guess people aren't reading Prabhupada's books. And that's another common thing. You'll find people that are initiated 10 years and they haven't read even one canto of Bhagavatam. And it's quite common. People are initiated and they don't have any idea that they're not supposed to worship demigods. They're not supposed to eat kami food. It's become very cheap. The quality is being sacrificed for the sake of quantity. So why is it happening? Well, ask the people who are propagating all these things. Why are they doing it? Maya doesn't sleep.
Less strict, but because of that, so many communities have failed. So, Does this same thing apply to that also? By establishing Varnashrama, that okay, we not keep standards very strict, and afterwards.
The idea that if we don't make standards very strict, then many people can come. But in Varnashram communities or temple communities or whatever. But what we factually see, if the standards aren't strict, then the whole project fails. So, purity is the force. It's a great art to keep strong standards and at the same time be flexible enough to allow for people's weaknesses. But once you institutionalize low standards, then everything is lost. Just like, for instance, in the West, if you know devotees divorce, remarry, it's just considered normal. There's nothing really that wrong with it. That's a compromise. That's a compromise with illicit sex. So that's a problem. But the thing is that the problem is there, and it becomes so common, and we don't know what to do, and then we don't really think of it as a problem anymore. It's still a problem. It's just like AIDS is a problem, but people don't talk about it that much. It's just people go on dying all around us because... what can you do, you know? So like that, you know, child abuse. People know it's a problem, but, you know, what can you do? You just have to get in. You have to go on with life. So we may think, well, you know, things are so bad, so we'll just go along with it. But if we go along with it, then there's no hope of any improvement. I'm pretty heavy on my disciples who... divorce. I mean, I don't encourage that in any way whatsoever. And they may, they may become discouraged and go away from devotional service. But what do you do if you say, okay, it's all right, never mind, and then people then just it becomes accepted. So what do? You sacrifice the individual or the standards? It's not easy. Yeah.
Actually, you can see that the sannyas is not supposed to do politics, but there are so many sannyasis in the GBC.
How is it possible that there are sannyasis in the GBC when sannyasis are not supposed to do politics? Well, the GBC is also not supposed to do politics. But it's inevitable when there's an organization and there's power and money and there's people who are less than Paramahamsas, that there will be what, if it wasn't ISKCON, we would call politics. So these things go on. Therefore, some people propose that there should be no sannyasis on the GBC. That was Prabhupada's original idea, actually, to have grihasthas. But then he changed that. It's difficult. I mean, an institution means there are going to be problems. Religion or actual religion is, you can't institutionalize. The very attempt to institutionalize it goes against the whole spirit. But on the other hand, we require an institution. So anyway, maybe at some point I'll discuss all these things in a book. Yeah.
Perhaps you say that although this situation, one can still follow Srila Prabhupada.
One can still follow Srila Prabhupada despite all of this. Yeah, one can do. But it can become quite difficult to do so also, especially if you're surrounded or you don't have association of others who are doing so or who purport to be doing so, but it's just like you may be in a city where there are literally hundreds of devotees. I'm thinking of a particular city, not very far from here. but in which pretty much all of them regularly eat kami food, and they, if anyone wants to not do that, they discourage them, and they say that you should, you know, you should take your wife out to a restaurant every so often. It turned out kami restaurant. So you want to have association with devotees, but do you want to associate with devotees who are saying such things and doing such things? So you can follow Srila Prabhupada, but it's a difficult path. It's easier not to go with the flow, but you have to see where the flow is going. So you can do, but it's not always going to be very easy.
It's in the same situation that Prabhupada was in when he was always alone, but he was always fully immersed in preaching, especially in the West, he did everything alone. So this preaching, this mood to go to preach.
The mood to go to preach, yeah.
It's the only solution.
To preach is the only solution, yeah? The positive is the only solution. So that's what I said, it's what we're trying to do here, to do something in the right way, preaching the right thing.
Because if I go out and I distribute a book with the intention to save that soul, and after that, I can think if this person go to some temple,
yeah, that's a problem. I shouldn't have said that. A prominent book distributor in America told me that there's only one or two, if he meets people who are interested and want to visit our centers, he said there's only one or two centers in the whole of America that he would recommend any person to go to. Because he's afraid if he goes to, they're more likely to get a bad impression of Krishna consciousness rather than what enlivens them in the book. When they go to the temple, they don't find the same thing. Several years ago, a leading devotee in Bangladesh, he told me that someone had asked him, a member of the public had asked him, should we follow what you do or what's in your books? So even the public can see. And maybe that will be the hope also, that as the world book distribution, as that goes on more and more and more, and as, you know, hopefully it'll go on more and more and more. There are certain envious people within our movement who want to stop. That's another thing. Years ago there was a North American GBC meeting about how to revive the preaching in America. And the first proposal they brought up was to stop book distribution. That's the answer. But instead they say, you see, people can't relate to it and this and that. And really seriously, seriously off. So, but as the books are distributed more and more, then it may be that the members of the public themselves demand that, you know, you give us what's in the books. That may be the hope. Okay, Hare Krishna.